Hello, and welcome to another Fools Media Group production of The Networking Fools, with your Networking Fools and hosts, J.W. Najarian and Bob Schechter, as they discuss business, finance, and lifestyle. Hello, everybody. This is J.W. Najarian from Networking Fools, and I'm here today with Gary Goldstein, Gary W. Goldstein. Gary is a Hollywood producer, started out as a lawyer. He's worked with business to help turn around business. He's worked in branding, marketing, and, well, we're going to get into it because there's quite a lot of stuff you do. Anyway, Gary's been a good friend of mine for years, and it's funny, I've interviewed all kinds of people, and Gary's always, you know, it's always your good friend that you get the last. But I've been wanting to do this interview for quite a long time, and I'm very happy to be here with Gary today. Hello, Gary. Thanks so much.
Kidding, JW? Okay, so a little editorial to start. JW is one of the greatest guys on the planet. I adore him. I admire him.
Oh, come on.
And we got to go there because Networking Fools is really an exciting idea, and I'm absolutely flattered to be a part of it.
So glad you could be on. I mean, you know, you've always made yourself available to me at all times. You've always been a gracious and wonderful friend. And out of all the interviews I do, you know, yours is the one I've been looking forward to for such a long time because Gary's a storyteller. And, you know, most of us, you know, we go through our 9-to-5 day and, you know, many things interesting happen to us. But you're one of the few that have been, I mean, has been out there and done some crazy stuff and has some great stories, and so I wanted to ask you about some of those today and kind of share those with our listeners.
I'm delighted. Well, you know, to me, it really all, life comes down to story. It's really that simple. When I was a kid, I remember the first book that really captured my imagination was The Scarlet Pimpernel, my first superhero, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ever since I was young, I just loved it. It didn't matter whether it was film or book or oral storytelling. I was just captivated by people's stories. And to this day, whether it's filmmaking, even that's what honestly, that's what was behind my wanting to be a criminal defense lawyer. I loved the theater of the courtroom and telling a great, compelling story and trying to persuade the jury and the bailiff and the judge and the district attorney and everybody to a certain point of view, a certain story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with filmmaking and all the entertainment areas. It's the same. Honestly, I find, and when I came a little bit out of Hollywood and I started doing more consulting to businesses, the thing that I think most surprised me was the power of a great story and how much business owners, entrepreneurs, corporate officers overlook how indelible, how persuasive, how important their individual story, the story of their company, the story of their team, the story of their customer. And so I think business is, I didn't know this before, but business is every bit as sexy and creative and amazing to me as filmmaking. It's just faster paced.
Okay, let me frame this story up, today's story. We're sitting here with Gary Goldstein, and if you don't know Gary, he was a co-producer of a little-known movie made called Pretty Woman.
Years ago, yeah.
Pretty Woman, you did... Under Siege 1 and 2, and also Mothman Prophecies.
Yeah.
And one of my favorites, we'll talk about that in a second.
the lesser-known indie films that even my family hasn't seen, we're going to get to.
Yeah. But we're sitting here, with the frame of the story, we're sitting here in the Hollywood Hills, of all places, in the gorgeous Hollywood. If you could see beyond these trees right here, you'd see a gorgeous view of the, I don't know what you call it, the Hollywood Valley. I don't know
the city.
The city is just above Sunset Boulevard, so we're in one of the, we're in a great area for this interview. But I want to go back a little bit, because your story is really interesting, but I want to kind of find out who's Gary and where did Gary come from?
Well, physically I was born in New York, but when I was 10 years old, I have one older brother. My father's family was all East Coast, my mother's was all generations of San Francisco, and we picked up and moved to And I grew up in San Francisco all during the 60s and went to Berkeley as an undergrad. My timing is amazing. I mean, I was a freshman at Berkeley in 68, the year of People's Park and Eldridge Cleaver and the ending of the war and all that.
And, of course, you just watched it and maybe inhaled.
Actually, here's what's interesting. a very dear friend of mine who'd been a neighbor was 2 years ahead of me. He was the A&R. At that time, all the big music labels decided that San Francisco was the next great outpost, and my friend Sid became the A&R guy for the Berkeley campus for Columbia Records, big label at the time. And he wore a second hat, and the second hat was he was the producer and promoter of all the concerts and cabarets for the campus of UC Berkeley. So he took all the big artists, put them on stage, produced them. So when I came over, he knew my love of music. He said, you're going to do it with me. You're going to be, and when I leave, you'll be the A&R guy for Columbia, and you'll be the sole head of chairman of music, or whatever they called it.
Wow, what a good friend.
So that's what happened. I became the youngest A&R guy for Columbia in the Bay Area at the time, and I produced the concert. We put on Joni Mitchell, we put on Graham Nash, we put on Steve Miller and Chuck Berry, and just on and on and on. We had a ball. All during this political heyday of, you know, uprisings and tear gas and the whole, it was very colorful. Altamont, the whole deal. So, I was a hippie. But when I came out of Berkeley, there was the problem. At that time, socially, there were very few acceptable options. You didn't go to work for a major corporation.
Right.
It was a different day. You became a teacher, you became an academic, you became, you know, a crusader. And my heroes at the time were the Tony Serras and the William Kunstlers who defended the Chicago Seven and the, you know, and I thought, wow, I could be a political defense lawyer, a criminal defense lawyer. So that's what I wanted to do. But I was out of college for several years. I was really kind of a lost soul. I was very much a dreamer and not very grounded. And I decided that, okay, I'll go to law school. I'll go down that track. I'll become a great criminal defense lawyer, and at least I'll have a law degree, so I'll feel like I speak an adult language. I'll have grounding. I'll get some respect.
Right. So the music thing, which is huge onto itself, I didn't even know that about you. How do you leave that?
I was an idealist. I was disenchanted with the inner workings of the music business.
Right.
If I hadn't been so naive, I might have stayed with it because I really loved music, and it might have been a great career. As it turns out, none of the pieces of our puzzles are misused time, right? They're not accidents.
Right.
Music is really what I think prepared me to be a film producer.
Okay.
How to work with top-tier talent, how to, you know, understand the business and the creative mix of things. So it really came in handy, but anyway, it didn't match me at the time.
Okay.
So I bummed around. I had some really silly jobs. I was a bit of a lost soul. I went to law school. I started to mention to you earlier, I worked in a really depressed part of the ghetto in San Francisco.
Right.
In lieu of the public defender, we defended the indigent adults, and it was an amazing chapter of my life, and it made me really appreciate my life relative to a lot of people on the planet.
In fact, why don't you go back on that and tell me the story about how you actually got into law school?
Well, I was rejected from law school.
Yeah.
And what had happened was I really had my heart set. This was before I went to law school, and I had my heart set on being a defender of the underdog. I was very romantic in my view of this.
Right.
And I talked to people and they told me about this foundation that was publicly funded out in the ghetto, a part of town, the southern part of the city no one went to unless they really meant to go there. It was a rugged, rough, unfriendly part of town. And where the projects and everything were. And I made up my mind I was going to go to work there. So I drove out there and it was... I was a long-haired hippie, and I was kind of lost, and I was intimidated and terrified. I found the ramshackle redevelopment buildings that housed the social workers and the investigators and the lawyers, and because they had unemployment, they had job skills training, they had everything, 120 or so people. And I walked into this beehive of activity. I think it was one of maybe three white people out there, and grabbed hold of someone's coat and said, I want to work here. I didn't know what else to say. And they looked at me like, well, who are you? I was not a lawyer. They had no money. What could I do for them? And I just wouldn't go away. And I literally kept showing up, and finally I showed up. They said, well, just come to a staff meeting and meet our chief counsel. And I went to the staff meeting, and I sat in the corner quivering. And they said, well, we have no money. I said, I'll work other jobs. Whatever it takes, I'll work for free for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay. And I ended up interning there for a year. And probably learned more in 1 year than you learn in 3 years of law school. There was only one law school that I wanted to apply to. Golden Gate, at the time, had the great criminal defense clinical program.
Right.
And a letter came, and I was rejected. This is almost a year into my internship. And I was thoroughly depressed, and the lawyers that morning walked in and found out why I was depressed and asked me the name of the dean of the law school and said, well, so sorry. Listen, we've got a busy day at court. We'll be back at 5 o'clock. Don't leave. We have work for you. So I said, okay. End of day, they show up. Turns out they had all gone home, canceled their court dates, put on their best suits, went down to the law school, met the dean, cornered her in her office, and said, we are Bayview Hunters Point. They were renowned, an impeccable reputation. And they said, do we have good credibility with Golden Gate University School of Law? And she said, yes. And they said, in that case, do you have a wild card admission? And she said, yes. And they said, great, write the name Gary Goldstein down. We want him in this law school. You won't regret it. She said, okay. 5 o'clock, they come back to Bayview Hunters Point. They call me into our ramshackle conference room. We're standing three guys in beautiful suits on top of a funky wooden table, each holding a bottle of champagne, saying, congratulations, counselor. And they explained what had just happened. And I literally broke out in tears. We had come to such a level of respect for each other and friendship. And, you know, I've seen it now 1,000 times since.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of building relationship, exalting relationship over everything in life, and building your social equity, and just being a good person.
Oh, I know, and I know you live that.
So, if it weren't for those guys, I don't know where I would have, what direction I might have gone. But I certainly wouldn't have made it into law school. Not at that time.
Right.
And, so here's the capper. The punchline is, I worked feverishly. I was terrified not to excel, right? Now I had a price on my head. So I worked hard, and I won it was a silly scholarship. It was called the Law Wives Scholarship. What did that mean? I don't know. But I won it. Okay. That's what's important.
I'm glad I didn't ask you.
And I remember for the law school newspaper, they took a photo of me with the dean and the head of the Law Wives organization or whatever it was. And it was on the front page of the newspaper. And in the photo, it had an article about it. But in the photo, I'm turning sideways talking to the dean, Judy McCaldy, and saying, Did I do well? Did I do good for Bayview Hunters Point? And she's smiling. So I explained why I'm not facing the camera to the guys. And it's a big life lesson, you know. I mean, I didn't practice law for long. It wasn't really my temperament. It was not nearly the romantic thing I'd imagine. It's a tough, harsh life. Really brutal.
There's some great lessons to learn here. I mean, remember Les Brown's story about how he became a DJ? By just he would not leave the studio essentially.
Yeah.
And this is your story. You just, you know, persistent. I'm here. I'm gonna work here. That's all there is to it. I mean, that's a great lesson. And then once you get what you want, then you need to follow through.
Yeah. You know, it's not mental activity. It's physical activity. It's like get in the game.
Yeah.
Be good. Put your shoulder into it.
Right.
Care about it. And just be yourself. Just, you know, I mean, bring your personality to it, bring your humor to it. Just be whoever you are, let people engage with you and have fun along the way.
So did you practice criminal law? Did you ever practice?
I did, briefly. But
okay. Well, I know you're really great with contract law. We've gone over several contracts together for different things, and you have an incredible eye for detail, especially when it comes to these contracts. So did you work in contract law, too, or did that come from Hollywood and the music industry?
Well, it's all of it. I love negotiating, and I love I pretty much always drafted most of my own contracts. I know when I have, what's the old saying? The lawyer who has himself for a client is a fool, or something like that, right? I forget the saying. There are times when I know I'm out of my element, and then I go get the professional help that I need.
Right.
But I've always been very comfortable negotiating. I actually like it. I find it very creative. Drafting, I do have this... I consider myself more of a concept, a creative and marketing mind. And yet, for some reason, I really love language and detail, and I like putting those contracts together. So I've done a lot of that. After I sort of failed out of criminal, I failed myself. And,
mm-hmm.
I actually had a personal experience that made it pretty impossible to continue being a criminal lawyer, as dating a gal who was attacked. And
mm-hmm.
It was a challenging experience, to say the least. So I just walked away from criminal. But I had friends who worked for this firm that was like a mini UN. It was only a 10-person law firm. But they had a gal from Singapore, a gal attorney from Iran, a fellow who was an attorney from Israel. It was from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they were business lawyers, basically. And they needed a litigator. Actually, this is great. Forget these stories. This is, thank you. So they said, Gary, we know that you're between, so why don't you come to work? We'd love to be with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm not a litigator. I've never done civil litigation. I'm a criminal guy. This will lie. And I said, I can't lie. They said, well, I'll tell you what, just meet our boss, meet the owner of the mm-hmm. firm. So on a Sunday, I drove to Marin County, his beautiful home, and I sat in his library and a stack of books that he'd written. And for 3 hours, I listened to this man talk. And I think during that entire 3-hour period, all I did was nod, smile, and go, mm-hmm.
mm-hmm.
No one gave this man respect. No one would listen to him. He liked me tremendously because I just sat and listened.
Another great lesson.
Right? It's very important. You got to learn to listen. And I learned a lot about the man during that time. At the end of the interview, he said, well, I hear that you're a great litigator. And I said, I wouldn't say that. And he said, what would you say? And I thought about it for a moment, and I said, I can honestly tell you I spent a lot of time in a courtroom. He said, great, can you begin on Monday? And I said, yes, I can. And I lasted not long, less than a couple of years. And the reason is because, I worked feverishly. Every day I was having to learn, I was in federal court, state court, I was doing sex discrimination, I was doing personal injury, I was doing every different thing. So I was a master of all, a jack of all trades,
right.
And truly a master of none.
Same thing when I was at Malibu.
It's private craft.
Yeah, when I was at Malibu, all day long, the beach cops are going by.
Yeah.
So you were a master of none.
Oh. It was unsatisfying.
Uh-huh.
Partially because I knew what I didn't know, which was a lot. And partially I took good care of the clients, but it was a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, it had no meaning for me. I didn't care about what I cared about the criminal side. I had a reason to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I had no purpose, no reason, no excitement about this civil litigation.
Right.
The cases that I was responsible for were of no interest to me. So I went to my father's office one day. My father was my best friend, and I was terrified. And I went to him, and I said, Dad, I just want you to know I just quit my job, but it gets worse. I don't think I just quit a job. I think I just quit a career.
Mm.
And without missing a beat, my father, who was way ahead of his time, looked at me and said, great. And I said, what? You're the parent. There's a lecture. And he said, no, I don't think you've been happy. I think you need to go out and find what really gives you joy, what excites you. And I said, wow.
Was that like just like your father, though, to be that way? Or?
Yeah. He was a very wise I mean, generationally, he didn't have the vernacular that we have today, but he was really ahead of his time. Just he was a very centered, smart guy who loved me, and I loved him, and wanted what was best for me. Very rare. That was a great gift, that moment, because it really set the stage for my understanding that taking risk is the best thing you can do. Every time you challenge yourself to expand yourself, to grow your capacity, to try new things, it's always been a little bit scary and hugely rewarding.
Right.
And it always works out.
Yeah, I just had a conversation with Spike Humor, as you know.
Yeah.
And we talked about this, and he said, particularly the same, you know, essentially the same thing. You know, you have to manage, you have to measure it to manage it, and you have to set up the plan and everything. But shooting from the hip is also important, and you've got to take chances. And knowing when to hold them, when willing to fold them, is not so much of a maybe a guessing opinion kind of thing. It's more if you've done the managing and the measuring, you're going to know.
Yeah, it's a combination. It's really about a balance. I mean, this area, right?
Right.
That's where you plan. That's where you pencil it out. That's where you see, does it logically work? Does it make sense? And get feedback. But you also got to check your gut and your heart and say, is this something that I'm so convinced of, so passionate about, that I'm willing to walk through the tough times? Because there will be. And if it's working as a business structure and it makes sense, and you've gone to your mentors and you've gone to your advisors and you've really thought it through and you've planned it out, and your gut tells you yes, and you have and you can build a team around it and share that vision effectively.
And you and I have had many of these conversations, especially over the last couple of years when the economy went south.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that, but was this the catalyst, after you spoke to your father, was this the catalyst for you coming to Hollywood? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I had a soul-searching, i.e. lost in transition period,
right,
where I tried to figure out, really, what do I want to be? Who do I want to be? And I bought an old Victorian home, I renovated it, and bought myself some time while expressing another side of me and having fun. And I just determined that I really wanted to pursue something much more purely creative, that it was really more in keeping with my temperament, that I'd be more satisfied. I'd probably be better at it as a result. And I literally just, all my life, had been in San Francisco, the Bay Area.
Right.
It was a little difficult to rip myself out of family and these years-long friendships and everything that was familiar. But I knew it was the right thing to do.
Right.
So I literally sold the building, and whatever fit in my little Karmann Ghia, that was it. Everything else went away. Whatever fit in that Karmann Ghia, which is not a lot, came to Southern California.
That was my first car, sky blue Karmann Ghia. I love that thing.
Yeah, I was so in. I had mine for 12 years. It was the love of my life, and came to this megalopolis that was sprawling, and I felt. But instead of feeling,
why did you decide to move down here? I mean, you just don't pick up and. I mean, why L.A., why Hollywood? Did you have something in mind that you wanted to do? Why not New York? What was the thought that made you say, I'm going to pick up everything and go to L.A.?
Every male on both sides of my family, and I say that because I'm going back in history when it was more about the men than the women, right?
Okay.
In a
patriarchy society.
And every man on both sides of my family had always struck out to become entrepreneurs, and I would say, you know, none of them were Rockefellers or Gettys, but they all did fine. They made a life for themselves. They did reasonably well. With one exception, none of them went into their father's businesses. They all struck out on their own as entrepreneurs in different areas. I grew up sort of, not consciously, but innately believing that that was what a guy did. That was your birthright, was to go out and create a business.
Well, let me back up to think. You talked about your father. What did he do?
My father was an old school merchant. When we were in New York, he'd been a salesman. He was on the road. He sold everything from toys to Western supplies to you name it. When we moved, he bought a business, and it was a wholesale retail toy, carnival supply, novelty type business. in the heart of downtown San Francisco, which he bought. It was a ramshackle thing, and he built it up into a beautiful business. Hard worker, right? Loved what he did. Loved people. He was like the mayor of, you know, of that part of San Francisco. People loved my father.
So you didn't follow in your father's footsteps necessarily, but sales probably learned, you probably learned something about sales, which probably helped you all the way through your career.
Yeah. I learned a lot of lessons from my father watching him and working for him. I worked for him on and off for years. But when I saw how he worked with his employees, when I saw the joy that he took in treating his customers a certain way, the way he dealt with the salesman who would come in to visit with him, I learned a lot of lessons from my dad. If I had to distill down to one nugget what I learned from my dad, he loved to engage people. He loved a great conversation. He enjoyed people. He really loved the salesman that came in and his vendors, and he even engaged the union reps that would come to give him a hard time. And he just he had a gracious way with people. He really respected people. He loved to hear about their issues and solve their problems and just have fun with them. And I think that's that culture that he created taught me a lot about how to be in business and just how to be a, you know, nice to people.
So you left. At this point, you decided that, law wasn't your thing. I'm not sure if we talked about after your father, if we talked about the business that you got into after that, the litigation and everything. And let's just go from here, because I do have it on the other point. Edit here. So, after you told your father, he was very gracious about taking the news that you were leaving not only your job, but a career.
Yeah.
Okay. So, now you're in San Francisco. What makes you close out everything and pick up and move to Los Angeles?
Well, it's the duality of life. On the one hand, San Francisco is a bit of a provincial community. And my family and my friends, I'd been there for a long time, and I felt as if the walls were closing in, to be honest. I didn't want to be a lawyer. I didn't know what to do. I really hungered for a new landscape, for something new. And I was not a long-standing, it wasn't as if since childhood I said, boy, someday I'm going to be in the film business. Or even that I wanted to move to Los Angeles. But I had a cousin who was living here, and I came to visit him. He was the only person I knew in Los Angeles. And the day I arrived, he collapsed. His lung collapsed. Into the hospital, in ICU, on Demerol. For 10 days, he was just inert, laying in bed. And so I told his family I would stay for those 10 days, and they could come when I got him home. And during those 10 days, I went for long walks. It was beautiful. I had a lot of time to reflect and think about what did I want to do in life. I also happened to notice how sunny and beautiful it always was in LA. I thought, I could live in a place like this. What occurred to me fundamentally was that as every guy in the family before me had struck out on his own and done reasonably well, I loved storytelling. I thought, my gosh, the film business is here. I had another hero. And I realized that the other guy that I really admired was a fellow named Maxwell Perkins. Maxwell Perkins, the greatest editor, second to none, in the 20th century. His whole professional life, Scribner and Sons, he discovered, nurtured, and was the editor to Ring Lardner and Thomas Wolfe and Ernest Hemingway and on and on and on. Many, I would say half of the great American authors of the last century. And I thought, with all humility, if I could be 1% to screenwriters and directors what he was to authors, what a fabulous life. So I made the decision before I left, while my cousin was in the hospital, that I would move. And 3 weeks later, I packed up and moved to LA. And I did build a management company. I didn't know what that was at the time, but when I moved to LA, I joined an outdoor health club. Should I repeat this?
Yeah.
Okay. It was so beautiful. I joined an outdoor health club. I was unemployable. I had no experience.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I played 3 hours of tennis in the morning, would swim in the middle of the day, and play 3 hours of panel tennis in the afternoon. And my game was good. But I met...
So you're in the best shape of your life.
It was spending
8 hours at least.
Adult summer vacation. I was in great shape.
Uh-huh.
And having a lot of fun, but also meeting a lot of people, but meeting them in a relaxed environment.
Right.
Really crucial, right?
A lot of guys in the industry, kind of.
Men, women, a lot of folks in the entertainment industries, TV, film, music, etc. Mm-hmm. I would just sit them down and befriend them, and then after a time I'd say, tell me about what you do. Explain that I wanted to get into the film business, share their thoughts. Would you, give me your counsel, give me some advice, mentor me.
Mm-hmm.
What do I need to know? What are the job titles? I didn't even know the job titles. Long story short, this was in the early 80s.
Right.
Their agents represented everybody. Managers only represented actors. And I said, well, I don't want to work with... It's not that I don't want to work with actors. It's not what calls to me. What calls to me are filmmakers and writers, directors.
Right.
And I said, well, I'm going to manage because I don't need a state license. I can just hang a shingle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that. And I quickly learned not to say I was a manager of writers, because people at the time would say, no such thing. So I just said, I represent. And if they asked further, I said, well, I'm an attorney. I built the business very slowly. But every time I went on the tennis court, I said, what do you do? If they'd say I'm a writer, or a writer-director, or a director, I'd say, gosh, what a coincidence. That's what I do. I represent people just like you. And I had a stable of clients very quickly. They were maybe not the single most talented people in the industry. In fact, they were almost as unemployable as I was. But water seeks its own level. When you're starting out, you're starting out.
Right.
And but my whole theory behind it was really pretty basic. I didn't care. I wanted better clients. But as long as I had clients, I was legitimate. I could pick up the phone and I could start cold calling. And I was not afraid to cold call. And I would call anybody, and if 2 out of 3 people were too busy or didn't want to deal with someone they didn't know or what have you, that was okay. Because all I had was a calendar to fill up. Breakfast meetings, lunch meetings, afternoon office meetings, dinner meetings, drinks meetings.
And these were mostly promoting your writers and clients?
I would call and say, I want to introduce you to one or more of my writers.
Mm-hmm.
Let's meet. Let me send you a writing sample. Let me take you to breakfast. Whatever I can do. And I did that rigorously for a couple of years. And over those couple of years, I developed a lot of relationships, rapport with many different folks, studio executives, creative executives, other producers, other agents, other managers, every type of person in the business. And by the end of the couple of years, I looked around and went, wow. You know, it's the old quote by Dag Hammarskjöld, the greatest diplomat of the last century, who was the Secretary General at the UN. And he had this wonderful quote where he said, never judge the height of a mountain until you're standing on top of it. And you'll see that it wasn't such a horrible distance.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years later, I looked back and I thought, wow, my landscape's entirely changed. I didn't realize it would be that. It's hard work, but it was easy.
Well, this is a good lesson for consistent persistency, right?
Yeah. Just stay the course. Just plot ahead. Take action. Stay in the game. That's anybody who's really successful says the same thing.
Right.
You know? It's, you need a smart plan, but the big deal is for being persistent. Believing in yourself more than believing in the obstacles or the punctuation marks along the way.
And how many times did you say, what am I doing, and am I doing the right thing, with all the no's I'm getting, is this ever going to work?
Oh, yeah. And how am I going to pay the bills? But you find a way.
Mm-hmm.
You find a way. And anyway, the business started to build.
Mm-hmm.
And the business started to do really well for a few years. And I thought, interesting. And it took me a while to realize I had this fantasy that, I should be able to knock on, at the time, Francis Ford Coppola was one of my heroes. And he had Zoetrope. And I would knock on that door and knock on that door and phone call and phone call. They wouldn't answer. They weren't interested. They had their group that they'd worked with time and time again, that they trusted, that they knew, that they liked, and they were comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't need some upstart like me. I thought, how unfair, right? Well, life isn't about fairness. So I had to create my own circle of acquaintances, and it worked. And then in 1988, the writers went out on strike. We knew it was going to be a bloodbath. It shut the industry down for not quite a full year.
Right.
So we talked about our friend Les Brown, who
right.
one of the many great things he says is that every problem, every obstacle is just an opportunity in disguise. And I turned to J.F. Lawton, the fellow who eventually wrote Pretty Woman, at that time had some scripts. I said, dust off a script. You're going to direct your first film. And I'm going to go out and raise some money. And he said, well, who's going to produce it? And I said, I am. He said, well, you've never produced. I said, that's okay. You've never directed. And I did. I raised a couple $100,000. We went out and we made this little film, Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death. Well, it's a funny story. Back then, when the video business was strong, there were people who would go to the film markets with some artwork
mm-hmm.
and a title and credits, and they'd sell the film that didn't exist. And if they sold it and got money, they'd turn around and go make the film. And if it didn't sell, they'd toss it in the garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to this fella for money, and he had all these glossy pieces of artwork that looked like finished films. And he said, pick one. And I said, well, they're all terrible titles. And there was one that said, Cannibal Women. And I said, "But I'll take that one. And I said, but wait, who are all these in these credits? He said, oh, that's my fiance's ex-boyfriends, but their names all mixed up. I learned a lot about how the film business worked back in those days. Anyway, so we extended the title so it became so silly no one could take it seriously. But we went out and made this film with a crew that was less experienced than we were.
But you had some... What was your, the actors in this thing?
We had... we got some good actors. We had Adrienne Barbeau, who'd been a big star, Shannon Tweed, who was well-known at the time, and Bill Maher, who was up and coming.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we shot it in... Well, between pre-production 2 weeks and shooting it 11 days and post-production editing 3 weeks... 3 days... We had a deadline. We had to get on a plane and go to the Sundance Institute. We'd been accepted into Robert Redford's Institute for their production lab
mm-hmm.
on the script that was then called 3000, became Pretty Woman. And I was suggesting that we wait till we come back to make the film, and Jonathan, my collaborator, mm-hmm. said, no, let's do it before. So we counted the number
of days. Yeah, I mean, doesn't everybody make a movie in 4 weeks?
Exactly. We didn't know. We assumed it could be done.
Yeah.
And so we did do it. We just counted up the number of days and divided up as best we knew how. And we made it happen.
So sometimes it's better not to know what you don't
know. It was
know.
The blind leading the blind. We had more fun. I mean, it was preposterous in hindsight
mm-hmm.
what we did, right? 30 company moves in 11 days. We literally picked up and moved our location probably 3 times on average a day.
Yeah.
People who later heard about how we made the film said, you guys are crazy. We said, well, but we didn't know that. Right?
And I understand you didn't even get a crew on the film until maybe a couple weeks in?
We were halfway through, a week into our 2 week prep period, and it was still just the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
Performing all the functions. We were two guys,
mm-hmm.
and that was not a crew. We needed a production designer and a script supervisor and a wardrobe person and a line producer and all these 40 functions. So we literally one night called up everybody we knew and said, invite everyone you know in turn tomorrow to our office. Tomorrow we're crewing the whole film. And Jonathan was in one office, I was in another office, and we just split the crowd. And I said, every time you find someone you want to hire, just bring them in for 2 seconds and I'll do the same. And over the period of, you know, a handful of hours, we crewed the whole film. And I would look at you and say, you're well-dressed, you're the wardrobe person. And that's how it went.
Right? And if somebody owned an Instamatic, they really...
And that night, I held my first ever production meeting, and I'm standing in front of 30 people.
Right.
I have no idea what to say to them. We made a great little film. It was a wonderful experience. That film ran on cable for 15 years. It
mm-hmm.
was considered for a no-budget film a success. But more importantly, there were a lot of lessons in that film. Certainly I got the bug, and I said, boy, the challenge of film...
Hello, and thank you for listening to the Networking Fools interview with Gary W. Goldstein. To listen to part two, make sure that you go to www.networkingfools.com. Thank you for listening to the Networking Fools show featured on the Networking Fools website at www.networkingfools.com. Networking Fools is the property of Fools Media Group. Networking Fools, Networking Fool, Network Fool are all trademarks of Fools Media Group, LLC, and this audio is copyright 2011, and all rights are reserved.